You're listening to First Point Japan's Spotlight Series, where we interview the people and analyze the things that matter for you to establish, build out, and accelerate your Japan business. Only at firstpointjapan.com, where Japanese business begins. And now, here's your host, James Santagata.
We welcome back Ken Charles. Ken Charles is the tech recruiting manager at Apex KK in Japan. Ken's a seasoned recruiter who's recruited for tech positions for both startups, gaming, and technical positions, both in the tech industry and financial industry in both the U.S. and Japan over the last 10 years. In the last two interview sessions we had with Ken, we first talked about the startup, technical, and gaming industry in Japan. And in the last session, we did a deep dive on Japan's gaming industry. For today's talk, we'd like to do a deep dive on the startup industry in Japan and also maybe compare and contrast it to what's happening both in the U.S. and globally as well, and find out what some of the similarities are within Japan and what some of the unique characteristics are that could help or maybe impede foreign companies that are looking to move into Japan or expand their presence here already. Ken, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, and I'm happy to be here to complete the trilogy.
Excellent. So let's start off maybe just backing up a little bit for those that didn't have a chance to listen to the first two. Can you just briefly maybe give a thumbnail sketch of your background and maybe focus a little bit on startups? I mean, how did you get involved with startups? Initially, I know you had a couple exits of your own startups in the States and maybe within Japan.
Yeah, basically, it was kind of by accident. You know, I wasn't one of those guys that really sought it out. In 2008, I was recruiting in on Wall Street in New York, and the economy got so bad that the number of open jobs that I had were just, I mean, drying up. Because we were working with companies like, you know, Lehman Brothers, for example, who just disappeared overnight. And I kind of, as a hedge for my day job, I founded a business on the side, more to, really just to kind of fill the hours of my day because there wasn't enough open jobs to work on in the industry I was in. So I founded a Japanese translation company, and I started soliciting work and getting some projects, and I was kind of in the right place, right time. I built the business up to a very sizable market share for the niche that we were in, which was a large part of it was online video distribution, which was just starting to begin in 2008. And then, fast forward a couple of years, the business took off. I made it my full-time gig. I built it up to around 20 people, and I ended up selling the company to a full-fledged tech startup out of San Francisco. And this was, you know, venture capital-backed, founded by a bunch of, Berkeley grads. I mean, it was very, very traditional, kind of what you would expect from a Silicon Valley startup. And then I joined them on the executive board. And that was kind of my entry into the industry. And, you know, I learned an awful lot. I actually came and worked in their office here in Tokyo while I transitioned the business over to them. And then after I had left that business, it was right before the earthquake in 2011. And I was in Tokyo, and I was kind of decide what I was going to do next. And I had an offer to basically be a co-founder of another startup in San Francisco again. So I packed up my bags right after the earthquake because, I mean, it wasn't the most alluring time to be unemployed in Tokyo anyway. So I moved over to San Francisco to launch a second startup, and that was in the ad tech space. And that company was ultimately got acquired 2 years later by a larger advertising company, and it's become a big part of their portfolio. In the native advertising space, which has since become a huge buzzword and hot topic.
Great, excellent.
Yeah, so basically, yeah. After all that, I realized, you know, I'd served inside of two startups, built two startups, and there's a lot of, there's a market need for somebody that understands startups, but also understands Japan and the business climate here. So that's how I got involved with the business I'm in today.
Excellent. So now within startups, I mean, we've seen, this is a value judgment, but some of these valuations are looking kind of crazy here in a way, especially when we see some of the things like the earlier, after the dot-com crash, the recovery in 2005-ish, where you got, Box.com, getting funding and stuff, and you see that Aaron's ending up with a sizable valuation, but maybe only holding 4% of the shares because they've been diluted and the valuations were so weak. And then we've seen this WhatsApp, and I think we were talking actually right before the show here about Snapchat, right? That was just announced, yesterday. What do you see happening, I guess, just overall from a 20 or 30,000 foot view with some of these startups, maybe in the U.S. or globally, and then maybe we can drill down a bit into Japan then?
Well, yeah, I mean, so globally speaking, specifically over in, what's happening in, say, California, for example, I mean, it's no secret we're in what they call a frothy market, which is a fancy way of saying, hey, guys, we might be in a bubble pretty soon, right? But, the fact is, I mean, the fundamentals now compared to, say, 99, 2000 are a heck of a lot better just based on the number of active users due to, mobile. So, I mean, there are users who are, if you look at the numbers, Snapchat, even though, they just took a small funding chunk from Kleiner Perkins at a $10 billion valuation. Wow. This is for a company with still no revenue at all. But something like, I don't remember the exact number, but it's like 60% of their registered users use the application every single day, right? That's like Facebook-esque, user engagement.
Right.
When you look at those fundamentals, you're like, man, $10 billion with no revenue sounds crazy, but at the same time, that's a lot of people that really seem to love this application. So, I mean, it's tough to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, certainly the valuations are, especially, lots of different space, not just the consumer space, it's out of control. Mm. And the interesting thing, talking about Japan, that trend has started to come to Japan just recently. Historically, the startups in Japan, a funding round, like a seed funding round, might be $1 million, $1.5 million. It's like as much money as little money as you would need to try to build a business. The Japanese VCs and the angel investors here are very conservative when it comes to placing their bets. And that trend has seemed to have been kind of accelerated rapidly just in the last year or so. Part of it is, I was looking back at some of these acquisitions and some of these investments that people made. So Masayoshi Son from SoftBank, very successful businessman. But way back when, the guy invested $20 million in a tiny startup out of China called Alibaba. And just recently with the Alibaba IPO going on, he stands to turn that $20 million into a personal gain of $58 billion.
Wow.
Or almost a 3,000x return on his investment. Mm-hmm. And then you see places like Rakuten, who have gotten involved in the merger and acquisition space, and they bought Viber for $900 million, just less than a year ago, I believe. And recently they just posted user sign-up numbers of over 600 million users now are using Viber. Wow. And it's like, man, 900 million sounded like a lot at the time, but now compared to, say, Line with their $10 billion IPO and Snapchat and WhatsApp, I mean, Viber was a steal.
Yeah, definitely.
So this trend, you see it with the early stage. One is a gaming company called Akatsuki, and they just did their first funding round at $14 million. And then there's an app called Gunosi, which is a news reader. It's kind of like Flipboard. They just, in the last six months, and this is a company that's only a year old, mind you, in the last 6 months, they raised $24 million.
Wow.
It's out of control. I mean, it's an incredible time to be an entrepreneur. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think one of the things, too, I was going to mention for people that haven't been recruiting, I was a former recruiter myself, is that I think what people don't realize is that, as a recruiter, you have the amount of inside information. I don't mean in a nefarious way, but I mean insights into all of the company industry is usually unparalleled.
Yeah.
Because the people that are talked to, you're talking to the business side people, right? The hiring authority or manager, you're looking at this, the people you're talking to in the market. So, for me, I also recruited in Japan years ago, but the interesting thing is even getting a peek into the domestics, right? You'll hear things when they say Sony has this problem, but after interviewing 20 or 30 people in different levels of Sony, you'll find out that what the experts might believe or pundits in the press is nothing for what's really going on, right? So there's a lot of these dynamics of that. So given that kind of thing, I don't expect you to share anything confidential, but just maybe broad strokes, what are some of the things that maybe difficulties or caveats that some of these startups, like say a WhatsApp or a Snapchat or whoever comes into Japan, what are some of the things they may face that could kind of knock them for a loop or may have them underperform that you've seen?
I mean, that's a great question, right? So the biggest thing, I mean, whether you're, say, you're a foreign startup trying to come here or really a startup anywhere, is, and this is one of those things that they do teach you in business school, but they don't necessarily teach you, you know, as you're, you know, learning to code and build a, you know, an application or a web startup, is that the relationships that you get via networking with the right people, that can make or break a company. I mean, it just absolutely can make or break. And it's the difference of, like, for example, if, you know, you have somebody on your team who is a natural kind of hustler or a natural networker who can get access to the right person in, you know, let's say a SoftBank, for example, right? And you can get your application endorsed by them or get some business development done with them. Or, for example, you can get an investment from SoftBank or from Son himself, right? If you're able to do that, you have such an easier path towards success. And part of the reasons were, like, you see, okay, well, Kleiner Perkins invests, you know, $20 million, which is a tiny amount of money compared to the valuation of Snapchat at $10 billion. But there's a strategic value there. Kleiner Perkins is somebody that's invested in Twitter and other, you know, these social media startups before, and they have access to exit partners, you know, people who might potentially be acquirers or people that can help the IPO. So one of the big pitfalls here is basically your ability to network. As that applies to Japan, you know, partnerships drive so much business here. The Gunosi didn't just get $24 million because they have an application that people love and they use. I mean, that's certainly part of it. But they have people in their team who know how to spend that money and are wisely investing it with the right advertising agencies where they have connections with, who are spending it to, do, you know, get them a good return on that money. Like, yes. 80% of that money that they've got is going directly to advertisements. And they have that because they have the right relationship. They're not going to blow that money. That's why the investors are trusting them. The relationships here on the ground are absolutely critical. And that's something that it's, if you don't, you know, if you're not prepared to deal with that part of your business, you're going to probably, you know, just keep moving along and not get that, you know, that hockey stick growth that everybody always talks about, that we dream about, right?
Right. And I guess the other thing is, two things that come to mind is, I remember the old years ago in the first wave of the .com, like when eBay tried to come into Japan. I mean, initially they were running it from San Jose. And there, you know, if I remember correctly, there was a lot of infighting at the time. Mm-hmm. And then by the time they finally got their act together and took Japan seriously, Yahoo Auctions, and Yahoo Japan Auctions had been launched, and that's it, right? They were game over, right? Yep. I know they've come back then. It's been many years, but we're talking, you know, 14 years have gone by, a lot of lost thing. But what's happening with speed to market, and also, I think, I don't want to say arrogance, but people think that their particular brand or value carries over to local markets, right? So obviously things like Facebook or maybe Twitter might, but what about other ones where it's not so known, and you roll into Japan and you think, hey, you know, we can at least get 100 resumes if we put out these particular ads, or recruiters will fly them over, and you find out that, one, there's not many, especially for bilingual candidates, right? It's 5 or 3% of the market, and on top of that, they really don't care. They've never heard of you, right? You've got to prove to them why they should join. Well, is that kind of a shock to some of these companies? Or
it's a huge part of my job, basically, is being kind of real. You know, that real come to Jesus moment of, you know, this is the reality of how you have to recruit in this market, and it's different than what you've been used to. You know, you mentioned places like, you know, so Twitter, right? Twitter wasn't an organic success in Japan. It was early on they invested in Japan, they made the right partnerships, they hired the right people, and very early on they were able to have a presence on the ground to help market it and get the partnerships and do that. They executed quickly. And yeah, people say, oh, okay, well, Twitter, you know, the Japanese language works very well with the 140 character limit, and it's why it took off. Yes, people love the product, but at the end of the day, there could have been a Twitter clone on the ground here that could have eaten their lunch and made it very difficult for them to move. And in fact, they did have to end up basically, there was a company here that got tons of traction that was not Twitter, but that was a Twitter partner, and it became a problem for a little while because of the traction they were getting. So
I see.
Some of these, you know, overseas startups, you know, in their home country, they've had amazing success, and they're a very sexy brand, like you said, and they have a line of candidates just dying to apply for them and work for them, but they people not, might not know their brand here. So what happens is expectations versus for the quality of candidate that you're looking for might be a little bit skewed. The candidate pool, especially for the bilingual candidate pool, is much lower, and then you throw in the people who are actually qualified and then also you know, basically risk tolerant enough to join a startup at an early stage is very small. So you don't get that huge flow of candidates that you might see where, you know, for example, if Facebook throws up an advertisement for, you know, we're hiring a CFO and they threw that up on online ads, I mean, they would probably get tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of applicants. That doesn't happen here. And I deal that with my clients all the time. They'll put a job listing up. In the first day or two, they'll get a flood of unqualified candidates, and then nobody's applying. They rely on people like, you know, myself to bring them candidates and walk them through that process.
Yeah, and I think we talked about this before. Even if I look back at like 2004-ish, or even 2005, mm-hmm. You know, when things were inverted in the valley, you know, people forget when it crashed, well, the NASDAQ was around April 2000, and then it took, you know, there's a little bit of time after that. And then, of course, 9/11 was the final nail in the coffin. But I remember a friend of mine that had a fairly well-funded startup, but they were looking, say, for, you know, sysadmins, right, with Linux. And, you know, you put an ad up even on Craigslist, and you'd get 500 candidates in a week. And the thing is, you know, I would say probably 80% were qualified, right? So now, of course, it's much different, but the fact is in Japan it was never like that, right? You'd be lucky to get 3 to 5. Wow. And a lot of these things, and it's, you know, and maybe one of those is the guy you're going to go with. So it's such a difference, I think, a different reality or mindset to even understand
it's,
that.
And it's so risky. Every day that goes by is an opportunity cost that you're wasting. You know, there's like a, there's a company that I'm not going to name, but, you know, they've been trying to hire their country manager here for going on 10 months now. And wow. In the meantime, there have been some domestic clones, Japanese clones of the, because Japan is, to be honest, in a large part, is a bit of a copycat culture. You know, there's a lot of copying and refining that goes on. And it's not shameful to take a clone from another country, adapt a quick Japanese version of it and start building it. But what happened is these companies, their clones, they started to get a little bit of funding here and there. So they got $1 million here, a couple other $2 million here. And they start getting user traction because they're expanding their marketing and their advertising and everything. And what's going to happen is it's going to end up one of these situations like, say, Groupon, for example, where they end up having to shell out tons of cash to purchase another company because they took too long to come to the market where they could have been the player from day one. Sometimes it happens with these small funded startups. Sometimes it happens with well-funded companies like Gree recently. You know, Gree is a notorious, you know, gaming company, and they've tried a lot of things, and they've been up in the market and down in the market. But just recently, they've actually gotten into the application cloning business. And it's very controversial among the people at Gree. But, like, there's an application out of the States called Hotel Tonight for last-minute hotel booking, which is very popular. Gree launched a version called Tonight with almost the exact same aesthetic and the same design, just geared towards the Japanese market. And Gree has huge resources and money to throw at it if they want to. And what's going to happen is Hotel Tonight, they're not at the stage where they're really going to be, you know, hiring country managers and expanding. But if they do really blow up and become a massive company, they're probably going to have to deal with the fact another Yahoo Japan situation, somebody else could beat them to market.
Right. No, that's a great point. Yeah. And I also think with this funding that you were mentioning, the VC, I mean, we see some large domestic funds now, right? Like the WIL, right? These have large, I mean, relative for Japan, relatively large funds. Not to mention you've got other people like Dave McClure, and these are quite aggressive of looking for smaller things to fund. So yeah, I think that people might come over and then find out that, you know, hey, some of these, maybe even the lower rungs may be occupied, right? Now you're spending time fending these guys off. Not to mention also fighting for those same pool of candidates, which makes it even harder to hire.
And here's the other thing, right? The, you know, those two things, right? One is the internet is a democracy of information, right? Everyone has access to the same information. So all this growth hacker tricks of the trade you see out of Silicon Valley and all this, you know, kind of, you know, lean startup movement, that's well in effect in Japan. And due to the success of Twitter and Facebook and lots of other startups, joining a startup and founding a startup in a lot of ways has become a much more attractive profession than it was, you know, even just say 5 to 10 years ago. It's not, you know, it's not people. Yeah, most Japanese college graduates, for example, are still trying to join, you know, a large company. But plenty of them are going the startup route now. Now you're seeing all these copycat, you know, things that worked in California. So you see incubators all over the place. See funds, large funds, small funds that are funding startups at a much higher clip than you did, you know, years ago. And what's happening is Tokyo is becoming a burgeoning startup hub. And it's for me, as somebody who really, you know, enjoys working with startups and, you know, been in a part of them before, I love seeing what's happening because it's empowering people to say, hey, if, you know, I could do this myself, I could build a company, I could build the next, you know, $1 billion startup if I want to. And that's starting to spread with the Japanese populace. And
yeah, and I think, I'm sorry.
Well, I said, and then for the overseas companies that are operating in the same space as some of these areas, if things like just recruiting and building a team and in your market entry strategy is lagging, it's because of a lot of times it's just, you know, like we talked about expectations or processes or whatever, it's a problem. And it's really going to cost them a lot of money and a lot of market share in the long run.
Yeah, and I think actually just quickly sketching this back, you know, Japan's one of these things where, you know, it's like a like an oil tanker, right? Super tanker. It doesn't seem to be moving. I mean, those still may be clipping along fairly well, but there's lots of momentum. You don't really see the ship turning, and then by the time it finally does, it's coming down, barreling down on it, right? And you're run over. And we saw this. I mean, the U.S. has seen this with Japanese steel and then automobiles and electronics. And I think it's the same thing, too. I was even thinking back to recruiting or staffing. I worked at Applied Materials working on the Japanese market back in around 95. Very difficult to hire anyone. You couldn't go to direct competitors because people would say, I'd rather leave the industry than work for a competitor than Tokyo Electron. I'm not going to go work for Applied Materials or this kind of company. So you had all these things. And then I think there was a risk aversion, social status, right? I'd rather work at Mitsubishi as a janitor, you know, for 20K a year than be a process engineer at Applied and make 90, right? And then I think there was some a bit where when the dot-com boom happened, there were a lot of people that scrambled. But then, you know, those people, a lot of them were very burned. And they got, when everything, you know, shut down and they kind of got left behind, there was a lot of risk and fear and some anger. Now, some industries that were very fast moving, like security, right? Companies are always either going out of business, reforming, or getting acquired. Mm-hmm. They had a higher risk tolerance. But I guess what we're saying now is it's got to the point where the whole idea of Japan, of even lifetime employment, that's gone away years ago. People are now very, you know, in 95, half the people didn't even know what a headhunter was. Mm-hmm. If you called them up, and I've talked to people that were doing this back in 90, 91, you could actually go to, like, one guy told me, he went to Hitachi and he said, I'd like to get the name directory, the Mambo. And they'd give you that in paper with all 10,000 employees and walk out and you call them all, right? There was no such thing as a headhunter. And if you called, the people would say, well, no, we don't need to hire anyone. No, dude, I'm trying to recruit you. Never been heard of. And now we got to the point where everyone knows what a headhunter is, right? Japanese, look at a lot of these firms where 50% of the staff are Japanese, right? They're all gaijin before. Everyone knows what it is. And you said incubators, younger people that have high risk or relatively high risk tolerance and money. So it's a whole new ballgame. And the other thing I've noticed, actually, where we've met going to some of these things like the Tokyo Hacker News thing, look at the amount of foreigners here that, for whatever reason, are in Japan, they're married to a Japanese or have ended up here, went out on their own. There's a lot of talented foreigners here that also bring, you know, the newest programming, you know, languages and methodologies and people with business skills and that are bilingual. And that also is kind of juicing up the local market as well in this hybrid thing. So I think people are a little bit shocked when they roll in now that it's not some sleepy town, right? There's a lot of talent being grown here. And, yeah, you might – if you don't get in quick enough, you may find out that you've got a local incumbent kind of sitting in your seat.
It's so true. It's not your father's Japan, right?
But, yeah, and I would say that even to me, this is shocking in the last 3 years, right, that how fast these things have turned around. And, yeah, like I said, I've noticed only the last 3 years I've been quite busy, but I've noticed just going out, the amount of talent is it's pretty amazing.
It's amazing.
Of after the earthquake and the people that have kind of backfilled and come in.
So. And keep in mind, too, the finance industry, for example, has pulled out a lot of the engineering roles and moved into other countries and things. And a lot of people that otherwise would have ended up in certain places, now very smart, they've got good backgrounds, and they're saying, hey, you know, this tech space is, I mean, it's pretty cool, and it's pretty darn lucrative for the right opportunity as well. So, I mean, the scene here is really transformed quickly, very, very quickly. This goes back to what I was talking about, the size of some of these acquisitions and the success that some of these, people follow the money. And if you look at, okay, wow, Sonsan can turn $20 million into $58 billion. Rakuten can buy a Israeli startup for $900 million and probably flip it tomorrow for $10 billion if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. This is there's money in tech, and Japan is figuring it out quickly.
And yes.
If it's for foreign companies that want to be a part of, the number three economy in the world now?
Yes.
You know, you got to move fast. That's the reality. And keep in mind, there's other things we didn't even mention. Abenomics, 2020 Olympics, right? The proliferation of the smartphone. I mean, it's like there's the things that are happening here are out of control, and that's why I'm so happy to be a part of it.
Yeah, no, it's very exciting, absolutely. Now let's just back up a little bit because this comes up a lot for startups. What are some of the approaches, or I don't know if there's caveats or best practices or better things to do when a company's first coming into Japan? I mean, I'm talking about a gaishikei, a foreign company. So it could be, your Airbnbs, whoever, in trying to find that first hire, or maybe trying to put in the country manager. What are you seeing, or that's good or bad, or maybe might help some of these people avoid, delays or pain that maybe avoidable?
Well, here's what I would say, and this is true, right? You don't want to. So there's different variety of how companies go about. Like the first part is, okay, how do you go about your recruiting strategy, right? Do you go with a, large retained firm and just let them run the search? Well, the retained search agencies are great at getting you, the corporate, the list of corporate directors from, a bunch of companies, but they're not really out there working the ground and meeting a lot of the kind of diamond in the rough candidates that the truth is your brand might need, because the guys that are already made it they're sitting on the board of directors at certain places. They might not be so excited to join this hip new startup, even if it's Airbnb, right?
So okay. Well, by the way, just to back up, just for people that don't know, so usually two types of recruiting: contingency. If you engaged a agency recruiter, you would only pay for a candidate if you agreed to hire them and they joined. Retained, you would have an agreement where you're paying them based usually one or two or three stages to introduce candidates and hire. So it's a commitment of money up front, as opposed to working with someone else, right? So these may be the Korn Ferry, not to say anything good or bad about people, but Korn Ferries, Heidrick, these type of things in general.
And okay. They run their search a certain way, and the truth is they don't have access to any resources that any other recruiting firm in Japan does. It's just, they branded themselves as, they're the global retained search guys. And not to knock them, they do certain types of searches they execute very well on, but if you're going to go the retained route, you really want to do your due diligence and figure out who you're going to be partnering with. Do they actually know the lay of the land? Are they out there meeting the right people, and do they know their industry, right?
Yeah, and I think one thing just to put on that too, just in the past when I was recruiting, what would come up, I think sometimes for people that are maybe listening and are looking to hire someone, because a lot of these are the global firms, they have these global contracts, right? So they're representing XYZ company in the US or Germany or England. So by default, the purchasing department or HR may say you need to use XYZ global retained firm in Japan. And, what you may want to realize or bring up is, and I hate to say how special Japan is, but it's possible that that may not work for you for the reasons that you've already talked about as well. So in Japan, you may want to get other quotes or talk to other agencies as well And otherwise, you may end up not only wasting some money, but more importantly, that time before you figure out what's really going on, that maybe they're not able to execute as well as they can in other countries just because the market is unique and there's a lot of cultural asymmetries that are faced over here as well.
Yeah, a large number of the kind of country manager searches that we'll get that will end up filling successfully have come after a failure from one of the retained search firms. And it happens a lot. You know, they do their 90-day contractual term. They do their role, and then they're kind of in and out. Then, okay, from there, it's like, all right, well, there's another strategy, which some companies do, which is say, all right, well, we want as many people out there, working on our, promoting our brand as possible, so we'll work with almost any firm. And they'll sign up a whole bunch of firms that'll work on searches. And that's, I would recommend highly against that as well, because what happens is you lose some of the control over how your brand messaging is being relayed in the market. So if you have some really just poor recruiters who don't understand the market they're in, talking to, lots of people about your company, they might get the very wrong impression early on of what you guys are all about. And then you're going to taint the market. There are plenty of companies out there that I know of who are just been basically blackballed by lots of talented people because in a lot of cases, it's a perception they have that is not even accurate. But because the early belief is, oh, this company is doing X, Y, and Z wrong with their strategy, or I don't believe in their business model, or their pricing is wrong, or whatever it is, then that's it. So I'm not going to join that company. And that happens all the time.
Yeah. I think even beyond another thing what you raised, and I'll raise these two as well. One is, obviously if you're dealing with a contingency contract, oftentimes the contract is based on who would introduce the candidate first. Well, there's a big thing in Japan, and I've seen this as well. You may have a limited pool of candidates. Maybe there's only 10 or 15 people that could work for this position that would be able to do the job, have the attitude, aptitude, and the company would like. Well, I've had things when I was recruiting, you'd call up and the guy said, well, I've already heard about this job from XYZ. And then you'd say, well, what'd you hear? And you find out, as you were saying, they pitched it completely wrong. Mm-hmm. Well, then what I found out is you'll pitch it properly. And at the end of that meeting, the Japanese guy will say, well, wait a minute. I'm really excited. Great. Let me introduce you. Well, actually, because he talked to me first, I'm going through him. So the fact is, as a recruiter, I wouldn't, unless I had complete control and had an agreement with that person, why would I want to reposition the company properly when someone else screwed it up so they get a fee and I get nothing? And then you end up with a lot of good people that are actually left behind because of this issue. That's a thing. And the second thing I'd say is with some of these firms, I'm not saying they all do it, but with some of these, you have to think when someone's got 600 to 800 clients signed in a space, where are they finding their candidates? And I know there's a few that actually, maintain, quote, separate companies, but they'll call in from overseas Thailand or whatever, and you'll put in one guy and pull two or three guys out, right? So that's another thing. You want to really think about who you're working with, and I guess the trust factor, right? The trust factor is, that's something else to consider. And again, the money may be a minimal thing, but it's, as you said, the opportunity cost. You make a mistake here, and you might lose 3, 6, 10 months or a year in getting your operations going that could kill you in the market.
Yeah, and especially when people know that you're coming, and if there's a competitor in the space and they get wind of it, they're going to be more motivated to execute that much faster, And
yeah,
that's
absolutely
the reality.
Yeah.
The other thing is, kind of finalizing that note, I really think, just pick a handful of recruiters that you trust that seem to really know your industry and then let them, work on the role. That's it for contingency style, unless you're going to go retained, which is a different model. That's it. Those are the only two ways that I would say go about the search. And then as you work with, these firms, you sign up 4 firms, 2 of them you're going to really like, maybe 2 of them you're going to hate. And then you kind of have a ballpark for the next step when you do the next round of hiring, who to trust and how to work it from there. But early on, you got to be really people. It's like you said, it could be an afterthought for who you use, but you don't want that to be the case. The other thing I would just say is about the process in general. The best candidates for almost any executive level role here in Japan, or almost any role really, come from passive introductions from people who have great jobs currently and are willing to have a first round kind of exploratory conversation where they can learn more about the company and can see if it's a good fit for them. But they're really genuinely curious to learn more about it, the candidates. And the if you go about it from an early stage, treating it just like you would any old interview process, where it's the company is just the company holds all the keys and is doing all the screening and is treating a potential president level person like a low level applicant, it can really rub people the wrong way. And we lose a lot of people off of jobs because of things like little protocols, little processes like that along the way, like forcing someone to fill out a long application before doing an interview, but things like that. Those are actually, in my experience in Japan, those are terribly backfired for the companies that have tried to do those style of hiring.
Yeah, and even in that, I think that some of these guys, it's possible they don't even have an extensive resume, right? Some of the guys may have just moved, brought along to different companies, yeah. And I've seen that as well. Give us a Japanese resume. The guy might not have one since college.
Yeah.
Right.
What I've taken to doing is work. Obviously I work with clients that understand that. I mean, that's my ideal. But then also, work closely with the candidate. So after an hour of talking, we could collaborate and put together a nice profile for his background. And okay. I mean, that should be enough for if the person's got the right credentials and they're interested in the role, that should be enough to give them that exploratory conversation so they can learn more.
Exactly. And then they'll be motivated if there's a good fit or match to go ahead and take the time to fill everything out.
Exactly.
And
that's assuming the company is very serious about their Japan search. If they're not very serious about it, they should probably go back and rethink why are they trying to go to Japan right now in the first place? Because this is an expensive market to get into, but it could be very, very lucrative. So you got to execute correctly. But and that goes back to all these startups that we're talking about. I mean, the ones that pull it off, I mean, you named a few, right? Yahoo, Twitter, Facebook. It's massively lucrative for lots of different things and all the enterprise companies. I mean, it's quite incredible on what can be achieved. It's just a matter of execution, and the speed to market has gotten so much faster because you don't need that much time and that much money to launch a startup anymore. So if you're a startup company, you need to understand that your competition has the same resources you do.
Yes, and local market knowledge.
And local market knowledge.
When you may not, yeah. Excellent. Okay, so before we wrap up here, anything else you want to share then before we wrap up then? Well, any last thoughts or?
I mean, the only last thing I'd like to say is that, I'll just do a, I don't know when you're planning on putting this up online, James, but there's the this event happening on the 4th and the 5th. It's the Startup Asia Tokyo. And looking at the guest list of who's going to be there, it's going to be a who's who of venture capitalists and quite a few of my clients and quite a few entrepreneurs and some really interesting people coming from overseas who are going to be here. If anybody's out there and is planning to go to the event or wants to try to check it out, I will certainly be there. I'll be scheduling some meetings there around my business. Just please give me a holler and I'll be happy to talk. My contact details should be on the screen, I think.
Yeah, that's right. They'll be on the screen, email and phone, and yes.
Yeah, so that's it. I hope to see some people there.
Sounds great. Okay, Ken, thanks again for your time then.
All right, thanks a lot, James.
Great. And this was Ken Charles from Apex KK. This was the final segment of the trilogy, so we'll have all three of those packaged for easy listening. The first one was overview of the tech, startup, and gaming recruiting, then a deep dive into gaming in Japan, and now this deep dive into startups. Thanks for your time, Ken.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This program has been a presentation of First Point Japan, where we interview the people and analyze the things that matter for you to establish, build out, and accelerate your Japan business. Only at firstpointjapan.com, where Japanese business begins.